Let's start with you becoming an MP, because you've only been an MP about a year. I interviewed you when you came to the constituency. You were working really hard, knocking on an awful lot of doors in the run-up to the general election, more than a year, I think. So how did it feel when you realised you'd won? The vote was over, you realised you won, and you achieved your goal.
I think pure shock, actually. I mean, this is great British tradition that you find out that you've won an election at 3:30 in the morning in a sports hall, in my case in the tennis courts in St John's, which is where I sometimes go with my daughter to do gymnastics. So every time I go and do gymnastics with my daughter, I have these flashbacks to the shock that I felt when we got the results. And of course, you've been campaigning really, really hard for the 6 weeks of the campaign, but as you said, actually the 18 months before, we were working the whole way through really hard to, you know, been a Conservative seat for a long time. Now it's a Liberal Democrat seat. So that, you know, takes a lot of effort to put that in. And, you know, when you find out at 3:30 in the morning, I think you probably can't quite believe it. You're sort of not really sure what the new normal is.
So then pretty quickly, you have to adjust to the new job. So what was it like sort of being inducted into the House of Commons?
Yeah, well, you know, it starts a lot quicker than that. 3:30, you find out. 10 to 5, you get your first email with someone saying, great, I've been waiting to speak to the new MP. And they, you know, whatever it is that their concern is.
So that's from the House of Commons?
No, from constituents.
From constituents?
Constituents' emails start, literally. You know, I thought, what took you so long? Why did you wait until 10 to 5? And then, so that was the Friday morning we found out. Into the House of Commons on Monday. And again, when you become an MP, you're suddenly juggling about three or four or five different big worlds. So you've got to understand the House of Commons and how that works. And it's 1,000 years old and it has all sorts of weird and wonderful ways. You're getting to grips with your inbox. I receive 1,000 emails a week. So, you know, everything that comes with that and all your constituents trying to get in contact and they need things doing for them and problems solved. There's the whole world of the media. Your family has to transition. All of a sudden you're away for half the week and all of this comes at once. So really the first 2 or 3 months, you're firefighting, really, is the only way to describe it, to try and stay on top of all of these different things that are...
Presumably you're recruiting as well, because you need a support staff.
Yeah, so you get elected alone, and I now have an office of 6 or 7 people, and the first people, you start recruiting them straight away in July, but they don't start, you know, people have notice periods, they don't start until the beginning of September. So that first 2 months you're alone and trying to grapple with it all on your own, and then once your staff start coming on board, you start being able to filter and process everything so that you can actually start to look forward rather than just dealing with everything day by day.
Is it outdated? You look at film of the House of Commons and in some ways it seems quite antiquated. I mean, is that all tradition? Is it good?
Look, I think you have to get the balance between tradition and between modernisation. So there are lots of things that the House of Commons does very well. For example, the way it conducts debates where everyone's referred to in the third person. You say he or she rather than you. And that's a great way of depersonalising debates about contentious issues. So that sort of thing we wouldn't want to change. The chamber itself is very atmospheric and it's quite intimate. It's quite small. And that lends to... It's a good forum for debate because, you know, when I'm asking the Prime Minister a question, he is 5 metres away from me. I'm looking straight at him and he's looking straight at me. And that intimacy, I think, lends a quality to the debate. I think some of the other things we might want to change, perhaps maybe how we vote and things like that. We have to sort of walk through these voting lobbies and it takes 10 minutes to do one vote. And there's actually a modernisation committee that's been set up in July and that's going to report back at some point later in the year. And I think it is debating some of these things and looking at some of these things. And, you know, in the UK, we don't do revolution. We sort of evolve our systems. And this is part of that. This institution has been around for 800 or 900 years. And we don't want to tear it down. We want to keep the stuff that's important and then maybe change some things. Particularly, a lot of MPs now have young families, and that wouldn't have been the case. Obviously, the roles of men and women have changed over the last 50 years. And so those sorts of things have to feed through into what the House of Commons is like. And we are looking at those things and they are changing slowly. So, I think the balance is about right.
Let's turn to some big issues, and possibly the biggest of all globally is the war in Ukraine. People everywhere have been pretty shocked by some of the developments we've seen, not really certain how to take in the events, Zelensky-Trump confrontation, Ukraine getting losing its aid and then getting it back again. You're a former army officer. You do study these issues. You've written about them as well. So what's your assessment currently of the situation in Ukraine? Is there a hope for any sort of ceasefire or peace deal?
So, and I'm also lucky enough since I've been elected to have been elected to the Defence Select Committee, which really looks at these issues in granular detail and tries to make suggestions and hold the government to account on those issues around defence and geopolitics. So I think there's a lot of noise that comes with a Trump presidency, and we saw that last time. And the trick is always to kind of cut through the noise and work out what the fundamentals are. And I think when it comes to Ukraine, we must accept that nothing has actually changed about Ukraine since Donald Trump got elected. And the only thing that's changed about a peace deal in Ukraine is that Donald Trump has started talking about it. But the fundamental issues that divide Russia and Ukraine, specifically around Ukrainian sovereignty and the fact it gets to choose its own leaders and choose what defense decisions it wants to make, gets to choose who it wants its alliances to be. Russia and Ukraine fundamentally disagree on those things. And Russia and Europe and Russia and Ukraine also fundamentally disagree about where the border is between Europe and Russia. And none of those things have changed since Donald Trump has been elected. And him talking about doing a peace deal doesn't make those things untrue. And so we still have these fundamental differences. And that is, I think, the situation that we're in now. I don't think we're going to get a peace deal with the current methods because of those incompatibility of the aims of Russia and Ukraine. But one thing has changed since Donald Trump's got elected, and that's it is very clear that the United States, under its current leadership, is not interested in the defense of Europe at all. And this is something that's changed. You know, really, this is the construct that we've all been working under NATO since the end of the Second World War, where European countries and America pledged to work together and defend each other. And it is, you know, America does the lion's share of that, but it goes two ways. The only time that collective defense has been raised and asked for by a country was when America triggered Article 5 after 9/11, and all of the European countries said, yes, we will work with you to defend you in your hour of need. So I think that's an important point to make. But what does that mean for us? So, well, if the Americans are not there to defend Europe, if they're not the primary security guarantor of Europe anymore, which is exactly what J.D. Vance, the U.S. vice president, said, then we have a problem in Europe because we need
to spend a lot more on defense, presumably.
We have a very aggressive Russia. We need to spend a lot more on defense.
But there's no money. There's no money, is there?
And we also need to do collective defense in Europe without the US. We need to understand what that looks like and what capabilities previously the Americans were providing that we need to provide. And yes, we do need to spend a lot more on defense. And, you know, this idea at the moment that we're going to start spending 2.5 by 2027 and 3% of GDP on defense by the beginnings of the next parliament, I think is for the birds. We will be spending 3% on defense in this parliament, 100%. The geopolitical situation makes that an absolute necessity.
But is it easy to ratchet up defense? I mean, you haven't got the trained people. We've been running down our armed forces. In the 1990s, we all thought the Cold War was over.
So you are right. We have been salami slicing our armed forces in terms of size and in terms of which capabilities we have. But a lot of that money, you know, armies are a bit like sponges. They keep their structures, and when you pour water, they expand. And that's not necessarily true of all the services. It takes a long time to build a ship, for example. But actually, the way warfare is going, the number of manned systems is much fewer, and you have a lot more drones that you just buy that do a wrap around those manned systems. So actually, now more than ever, it's easy to expand your military footprint much quicker by adding in money. And that's something that we do need to do, because not only are we, you know, got a war to fight in Ukraine, we have to support Ukraine in fighting that war, but Britain has troops in Estonia. We have 900 troops in Estonia, right? Once Ukraine is done, that is exactly where Russia is going to look next. And we need to make sure that those troops are sufficiently able to deter Russia in Estonia. So that is a vital national interest.
So you would be in favour of more defence spending now?
The pathway is to be of ever-increasing defence expenditure. The question that is being settled at the moment, that is being discussed at the moment, is what is the mix between tax rises, spending cuts, and I suspect borrowing. And if you look at Europe, what Europe has decided is that they are going to borrow lots of money to flesh out their defence structures. And I think that that is the answer that we are going to get to in the UK, but it might take us a little bit longer. But I suspect that's the direction of travel.